Actually, do you want to start with beer ethics?
No, no, we're going to start with a brief dissertation on... No.
Actually, my...
Will is just trying to get over his shock at seeing Jonah put his beer on top of the stove. He's speechless.
Well, it's funny, because actually one of the supporters, one of my friends, he said, "I like when you guys talk about beer." And he's like, "I'm just going to leave that really open-ended." So this is me trying to fulfill that request. We can do that for 5 minutes, talk about beer. Do you got a riff on beer? Beer ethics?
Beer ethics. But here you are violating it and drinking a non-craft...
I know.
Non-craft beer, so...
Yeah, I'm poor these days, so I am drinking conglomerate's beer.
What? I don't know. What other than that...
To me, it comes down to the price point, I guess. I don't really know what he's looking for talking about beer. It's like...
Beer ethics.
You know, the one tattoo I ever thought about getting was... Yeah, the ancient Egyptians.
Okay, we'll start with that.
The ancient Egyptians. I already turned it on. Because we're doing the 30-minute one, we got to blow through this.
Right.
The ancient Egyptians said saying hello to each other was bread and beer.
Right.
Everything's good in the world.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so I thought I'd make my own hieroglyphs and maybe tattoo that on my body. But that's the only tattoo I've ever considered getting myself. That's as much as I have to say about
beer. So bread on one wrist and beer on the other.
Oh, that could be. I was just going to put them next to each other.
Oh, no, I think you ought to make it bilateral.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
See, this is why it's good to get consultation before you put something on your body forever.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the tarot because, of course, the tarot started... in Egypt, from what I hear, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, the archetypal symbology originated in Egypt.
Well, I you probably know more about it than I do. My mom gave me this book. It's Christian Hermeticism take on the tarot, and it gives just loose interpretations of certain cards and what they mean, and obviously mythology it makes these interesting suggestions about how myth is like the future, you know, like myth is how we all interact with the idea of time, which I think is kind of an interesting mm-hmm. suggestion.
Yeah
But do you want one of these conglomerates?
Well, sure, since my beer is empty.
Yeah,
I think your friend, the final thing we could say is I'm sure your friend would agree that the only time he ever turned down a beer was when it wasn't offered. And my cup is empty. So the happy sound. So the moon goddess, Isis, goddess of the moon. And the moon is one of the big cards.
Why is the moon one of the big cards?
The moon's one of the major arcana. But it was one of the big cards for the unconscious.
Yeah.
And which brings the interesting idea of time and dreams.
Mm.
And the moon. The chronic moon, 28 days. And...
couldn't it just as easily be the sun, though? I mean, why couldn't...
Well, the sun comes up every day, but the moon... is time. That's the calibration of time. You can always depend on the moon to figure out something changing.
Really? The moon's just a big dead rock. I mean the sun is why everything exists, right? I mean, like...
But the moon has the chronic... I mean, let's face it, man. Women, menstrual cycles, 28 days.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's... And the Arabs get that right. I mean, every 28 days, they don't measure an artificial decade according to tens. They measure by the moon, and all their festivals are in 28-day cycles. So.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say, because you brought up decade, I thought you were going to say all their festivals are on 28-year cycles, which would be really interesting. That would actually make a festival a festival. If it was every 28 years, I mean, that would be a big deal. That would be a...
Jonah, with this insight, we could start our own religion.
Well, I've been saying for years... Christmas is boring because it happens every year. If it happened every 5 years,
yeah.
Christmas could be like a real celebration, you know? It's like,
if it were a movable feast and it could end up, you know, by intercalation, it would be like, you know, in March some years, June some years.
Sure.
Yeah, let's get some excitement and some uncertainty and everything.
Yeah.
When is Christmas this year?
Yeah.
You know, like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you need priests to tell you, right?
Right.
Or in modern times, a bureau of letting people know when Christmas is. Yeah.
But then how that wouldn't be very populist. If you got to listen to some priests tell you when the thing is going.
Well, I think that's the point. Christmas is a solar celebration,
right?
So yeah, you're kind of missing the point, Will, but yeah, you know.
Well, what so I've read Hemingway's A Movable Feast. What is that in reference to? I actually don't even know what the idea.
A Movable Feast is a Catholic priest that is a Catholic celebration that is probably by the moon, you know. It moves, you know. It's probably a vestige of the old moon cycle, where you would count the moons. You know, you can't count the days, but it's pretty easy to count the moon. I mean, now that's one of my best lines ever. It's pretty easy to count the moon.
You know, when I was in college.
Thank you. Now, thank you. Talk about beer ethics. Thank you, beer. I had that brilliant association drinking Bud Light.
Oh, wow.
Now, if we got a Bud Light endorsement, then we'd have something.
Oh, then we'd really have something.
You know, these craft beers.
Yeah, yeah, man, yeah. They don't have the extra cash to throw around for endorsements. Oh. No, but I just remember when I was in college, I took an astronomy class because I was like, oh, this is going to be fascinating and amazing. And I found it so terribly boring. Maybe the professor just sucked. But one of our tasks was to go out every night and draw a picture of where the moon was.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do it. I was like, I couldn't be bothered to care. Maybe it was just because I was young, but...
No, you were not an Egyptian or Abyssinian or something like that, in which that was the goddess. Man, that was God. Like, okay, quarter moon, half moon, waning moon. I mean, these are all like...
But when you have other ways of measuring time, doesn't it make it kind of superfluous?
Like, that was their only way.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, and then you had the Pleiades, you know, the rising of the Pleiades, Orion. I mean, you had certain things going on, but...
Well, also in Egypt, where the weather cycles are not as dramatic as in the Northern Hemisphere... When it's pretty fucking obvious when it's wintertime. That's not really anything you're ever up for debate.
Greece is quite far north, though.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So they had to. Yes.
Okay, so I'm gonna throw something at you from. This is from a meditation on the Wheel of Fortune. Okay, well, first it talks about Nietzsche's idea of the eternal recurrence. And so in Christian Hermeticism, there's this idea that, like, well, that would be the scientific way of thinking about it, that everything just recurs on the same theme. But now, given that the world is a determined quantity, it is calculable. In the last analysis, it is only a determined number of particles and or units of energy. Therefore, the number of combinations of these particles is no longer unlimited. The limit must be reached sometime. And then past combinations will be repeated. The eternal return of everything is therefore an inevitable conclusion in a world understood as a closed circle. In a world which is a closed circle, whose matter and energy are a constant quantity, there are no miracles, because the cosmic notion of a miracle entails inconstancy of the quantity of matter and energy in the world. A miracle takes place when the energy of the world undergoes either an increase or a diminution. This presupposes an opening in the circle of the world. For a miracle to be possible, the world must be an open circle. The world must be a spiral, i.e., it must be an uncreated sphere or a Sabbath according to the cosmic myth. Now, religion, all advanced religion, teaches that the world is an open circle. For this reason, it insists upon the reality of miracles. Miracles, the supernatural, are a reality of action from beyond the circle of nature, which appears to be closed. This is the reality of the cosmic Sabbath. The quote-unquote good news of religion is that the world is not a closed circle, that it is not an eternal prison, that it has an exit and an entrance. There is an entrance, which is why Christmas is a joyous festival. There is an exit, which is why Ascension is a festival, and that the world can be transformed, such as it is, into such as it was before the fall. That is the good news of the Festival of Festivals, the Festival of the Resurrection, Easter. The world as a closed circle, the world of the eternal return, the world where there is nothing new under the sun. What is this in reality? It is nothing other than cosmic hell, for the idea of hell can be understood as eternal existence in a closed circle. The closed circle of egoism would then be subjective and individual hell. The closed circle of a world of constant energy would then be objective and cosmic hell. What do you make of that?
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a lot of pretty shaky assumptions.
Well, yeah. All spiritual speculation
but
does.
The main, yes, but the main metaphor is spectacular. Yeah, yeah, absolutely, man. It's fantastic. Who wrote that book?
It's an anonymous person, actually.
Tremendous.
Yeah, that's,
which is what we want in an open system.
Yeah, right. Yeah, anonymity.
That is tremendous, man. I love that. Heisenberg would have loved that, man.
Do you think?
Well, at the subatomic level, it's all probabilities in an open system.
Right.
So you're always factoring in terms of.
But then there's the idea that energy can't be gained or lost, right? That's the system that's closed.
No, Heisenberg said that energy particles will come in and out of existence in response to whether they are needed or not in the system. So you have a certain indefinite infinity on both sides of the equation.
Really? He did?
Not only in time past, forward, and backwards, but vertically as well. Yeah, yeah, it's like incredible, man. And they have to factor that in order to do all these mathematical calculations as to where the moon's going to go, where projectiles are going to go.
Well, no, you can just use classical,
right.
Yeah,
right, probably
classical physics
probably,
to do that stuff. But yeah.
But as you know, the whole thing about uncertainty. Allows miracles. It allows incredible synchronicity.
Yeah.
Everything happens in this uncertain world of incredible improbability at any moment,
How would you define a
miracle? Unfortunately, it happens for evil, too.
Sure.
That's what we hate. Trump. Who would have fucking thought, man?
A miracle of evil.
A miracle of evil.
That's a great definition for Trump. I kind of love that. He's a miracle of evil. it's piss it all sides off there.
Oh, this, yeah. Oh my God! Yeah, exactly, man. Yeah, no, that's tremendous, man. When you read the tarot, it's chance. You're shuffling the cards,
right?
You're laying them out, but I mean that deck of possibility. Once you start shuffling it, and the mood of the moment, as we're talking, of course, it's a November night, dark night going down, and 2 weeks after All Souls Day, and it's a perfect night for the tarot, but I read tarot, and it's just extraordinary what happens.
How do you do it? How do you read tarot?
Well, number one, it's got to be twilight, like right now.
Okay.
Two, I have to be drinking, which is self-evident or presupposed or foreordained. And three, it can't be anybody I know.
Okay.
And four, money is never involved.
Okay.
But
money's never involved. That's the key.
That's the key. Well, I think, yeah, they're all very important, but the main thing is that I don't know them, they've got to come in off the street. Somehow we just talk. I've had a beer. It's dark. They're not, and then. So I've actually done at least two or three readings where I looked down and I looked at him and I said, I'm not sure you want to hear this. And they looked at it and they said, no, it's worse than that. That's happened twice, where these people were going through hell, true personal emotional hell. Both times it had already happened, and they were just kind of like going through it. But I said, okay, I'm fine with that both times. And then I've done a lot of really wonderful readings, you know.
Really? Okay, because like, the skeptic in me was going to first say, well, doesn't it basically suggest that anyone who's willing to have their tarot read in the first place is probably going through some change, some terrible thing where they want some...
Right. But it's usually that, and I you're absolutely right about that. But the second point is that the two really extreme cases involving child sexual abuse were like that. It was like I was like freaking out.
You picked up on that just from looking at cards?
They're the ones who shuffled the cards three times. They're the ones that cut it. All I did was, you know, lay them out in sequence.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, that's all I do.
Okay.
And there were other times, yeah, they were going through changes, but it just didn't have that, you know, vibe. It just didn't have that kind of, what's the word, heavy oscillations of real violence were going on in that deck, you know. The really heavy evil cards were like coming out, and I didn't want to be dishonest, you know. But I just kind of looked at them. I don't think I even said anything. I think I just kind of looked at them as they were coming out. I lay the cards down.
Yeah.
They cut them, then I lay the cards, and I just looked at them and I went, really don't.
But from my reading of this book, there's not a lot of like. In the classic tarot, there's not a lot of really heavy cards. Like they're all kind of.
They're all really heavy.
They're all really.
They're really, and especially in sequence. Oh, good stuff.
Shakespeare.
$3.
Do card cash?
Certainly, yeah, both. We just got a new listener. Man, that was tremendous.
Yeah.
No, the element of total chance and chaotic and an open-ended universe is in the tarot. I mean, that's happened every time, Jonah. I mean, and the other people were kind of going into like minor life changes. But I could see where, you know, the money was in place. You know, the money is pentangles. Work is the wands. Swords is a certain amount of stress and maybe suffering. And then, of course, the cups are the unconscious and...
See, these are all the kind of practical tarot reading things that I did not get out of this book. What I got was much more esoteric and like you can open it on any page. Well, here's the moon. What is the most general property of the material world? It is extended. It presents to us objects external to other objects. And in these objects, parts external to parts. No doubt it is useful to us, in view of all of our ulterior manipulation, to regard each object as divisible into parts arbitrarily cut up, each part being again divisible as we like, and so on ad infinitum, to this possibility of decomposing matter as much as we please, and in any way we please, We allude when we speak to the continuity of material extension. Well, these are the kind of things they talk about with the, like the moon, and then
what?
it's almost weirdly academic without ever saying anything anyone in academia would ever take seriously.
Well, no, I mean, the guy took a elementary philosophy course, you know. I mean, that's really bizarre.
Yeah.
That's really bizarre, man.
For this reason, not only science decomposes objects into chemical substances, the latter into molecules, molecules into atoms, and atoms into electrons, but also occult science decomposes. For example, the human being is decomposed into three principles: spirit, soul, and body. When it is a matter of the place that man occupies between God and nature, or into four principles. And then he talks about Raja Yoga.
Well, he's picking an arena he can criticize, right? I mean,
right.
No, that's what I was saying. I mean, that earlier introduction that you did, I mean, he's playing really loose and fast the whole time. And I don't know, go ahead.
Well, you know, it is strange, but it did.
That was an unfortunate pickup on the moon. I mean, good. How could he possibly talk about the moon that way, man?
Well,
the moon is the goddess Isis. I mean, that she draws the ocean to her. The fish copulate and rise to the surface. Women menstruate. I mean, this is like the real pulse of the earth, you know. And yes, it is just a rock up there, but that's the way it's all put together. I mean, without the moon, people are really worried about the moon getting farther and farther away from Earth in a billion years. I mean, there's strong anxiety about this.
In a billion years, people are worried about... Okay. Well, here. Our sensations, symbolizing external movement, do not resemble them, the phenomena of them, any more than the undulations of sand in the desert resemble the wind which raises it up into sand dunes.
Which is totally false.
How is that false?
The sand is the mirror of the wind that's moving it. And even the rhythm of it, even the energy of it, everything. God, this guy is the most total idiot I've ever heard.
Well, a lot of it is quotes. So this is actually a quotation from somebody else. Oh. But yeah, this goes, any more than the ebb and flow of the sea resemble the combined movements of the sun and moon. They are the symbols of it.
Oh, my God. Jesus, this guy's a total idiot. What are you talking about, man? Do you realize the moon?
I feel sympathetic to that.
Do you realize the moon causes tectonic movement in rock? And that you've got, yeah. I mean, I've actually been up in the mountains in the spring, in the late winter, when landslide, you can hear rock slides. You can hear rock ripping off the sides of the mountains. It's coming down the mountains because of the pull of the moon. I mean, that's just fact, you know.
Well, I mean, gravity is it's obviously a huge force. But, I think maybe you're slightly misunderstanding.
Okay.
The opinion of Kant, which reduces inner movements to simple symbols of a hidden reality, is truer and more rational than naive realism. Science ought to resign itself to being only a symbolism conscious of itself.
That the earlier part was Kant?
Well, no, he's making a reflection on Kant.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Anyway.
Gosh, Jonah, we got out of my realm really quick.
No,
I think your point.
Your point's
this indivisible stuff, man. I mean, there is no indivisibility. I mean, when you cut a steak up in order to cook it, right, in a chow mein or something, I mean, yeah, you divide things up, but where else is there any division? Or you divide, you know, blocks in a city, but I mean, God, all this dividing thing is
irrational. Well, then I think you're a scientist in the sense that you do think it is all part of a closed circle to some extent or another. Like the symbols are the representation of the reality, and not as a Wittgensteinian term, they're not just the representation of themselves.
Well, yeah, but you're forgetting, you're in a three-dimensional, you're forgetting time and the narrative of all these events, you know.
Uh-huh.
And in that, no, it's definitely an open, it's all an open thing. And well, you taught me a lot today, you know, about the whole, what the guy is right about is the open uncertainty brings out incredible possibilities. And I never thought about it. Whether it does or not, I don't know. But gosh, who knows? You know, I'm having, every day we have these incredible synchronicities and coincidences, and you're going, wait, what's going on here, right?
Yeah.
And you're going, but I just don't like this idea of, you can't divide anything, man. It's impossible to divide anything except in, you know, gross anatomy or something, cutting somebody's liver into, I mean, or being a butcher. A butcher divides things.
Well, you just said you can't cut up a steak.
That's all about you can do is cut up corporeal matter, you know, slice it up, but you're not really dividing it, because divide means to cut in two.
Okay.
And even then is an impossibility, okay, because you can't cut anything in two perfectly. How am I doing? Drinking Bud Light.
Yeah.
I'm philosophizing like a Bud Light drinker right now, Matt. I've got to stay on the home brews.
Yeah.
You are what you drink.
That little.
That's ethic. The ethic for our major supporter. You are what you drink.
And there's something, right? It's like what you told me about witches and hops is like good hops. You know, the craft beers, they've got better hops.
Perhaps.
And hops are curative, right?
Right.
That's something to be said for the better beers.
Right, and an intoxicant. Yeah, the more hops, the better. And yeah, gosh, how can we go beyond this?
Well, okay, I've got one speculation that I had while reading that.
Okay.
And it just made me think, I was like, okay, so if everything is an open, if it's not a closed circle, we're using a little, a few, what's the term? Not phenomenological, but there's a philosophical term. It'll come to me later, but... I've been thinking about. Well,
I like the phenomenological though.
Yeah.
Because phenomenology does deal with the open circle, because it's all about your perception of your perception.
Yeah.
And that creates a lag in which there's all sorts of possibility. You know, that's where everything happens. Is that time lag between perceiving. And then perceiving your perception, judging it, and already you're moving on, right?
Mm.
So there's a pretty opening loop there, man.
Yeah.
And you as a writer know that's what's fun about writing, is like you get in these states where you're reacting to your perception of what you're doing, and that's the opportunity you have to write something new or think something new.
I think that's good. Cheers. That deserves a cheers. And I think it goes smoothly into the thought I was having, which is, okay, so Richard Feynman opened me up to this idea of, like, on a literal fundamental particle level, every 5 years, all the particles in our bodies have been essentially remade. We're, you know, because we're constantly streaming in through other atoms, and our bodies are constantly being reconstituted with other materials, and yet memories still exist. So my speculation was something to the effect of, if every time you create a memory, are you actually in a certain sense bringing a different kind of particle into the world, because of each individual memory? I mean, it's a little woo-woo, like, you know, like open circle stuff, but I was thinking, like, you know, like, what is the atomical content of a memory? And they all have to be somewhat unique, right? To some extent or another. I don't know. That's just the thought. And I'm sure if I asked a physicist, I don't know what they would say. But
well, the Greeks would love it because memory was, you know, a goddess. Memory was number one, you know. Mm. And it's so interesting today that this guy came in and we were talking about the absolute, how you would go, how the yogis and these people go to a point where there's no narrative, there's no story, there's no sentence. It's just like, boom, consciousness of God, right? Without words. And I kept saying, geez, I don't know, man. That's pretty crazy, but, and then I made the point of that if you have no memory, see, my point was that I sit here and I watch these cars go by, and when you watch motion, your mind has got to particleize it. It's got to go, okay, it's there, and it's there, and it's there. And that's how you get that movie kind of time frame, right?
Sure.
And I mean, I do it. I try to make that car go by smooth, but I can't. It's always, and that's the way my consciousness is. All my life, it's just like I'm just doing like these fragments of sentences, right? Just kind of keeping track of what's going on, right? And I said, what I do know is that when I smashed my hip and they gave me this great drug, that takes away all memory. It interferes with the brain's ability to remember anything.
Right.
And at that point, consciousness ceases. Because you cannot remember the previous moment. If you cannot remember the previous moment, you are no longer conscious. You're like gone, right?
Right.
And he did not get the subtlety of my argument. But you're absolutely right, man. Memory.
Well, I think that's what he's talking about, right? Is consciousness is gone. I think that's what that's where the magic happens in these yogis, is your consciousness is gone, and that's what is the constant stream of the particles and the things that are happening inside your brain, is removing that, and then what? And then what? It's anything is possible, I guess. The idea is then you're so in touch with the universe, you can warm up your internal body temperature and not, all those weird things that yogis can do.
Paul, we're hoping you're listening to this because you were very angry when you left here today. That's true. That's great. That's absolutely right. He was trying to tell me that. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that is the path into that consciousness. But it's not consciousness. It's like, it's not conscious, man.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, the one good thing I was saying that he lives up in the woods where he's in the natural world the whole time. And I'm saying, you know, I'm here in the store 6 days a week. When I go out in the mountains is the only time when I'm really happy and free of the narrative, right? And after talking with a little bit, I did recall that when I'm in the mountains, I will have moments where the sun is there and all I do is feel this sensual communion with the pulse of the sun, and it's like there are no words. I'm happy.
Yeah.
So he got me to understand that. And you know what's so ironic is that I said, thank you, Paul, for enlightening me. Of course he thought I was being a smartass. And he said, don't mock me. And I said, Paul, I wasn't bad. You did. I saw that really at those moments I do lose the narrative, but it's a sensual thing. It's like the communion with the divine is a sensual thing for me. So obviously I'm still holding on to my consciousness, and I'm aware that it's a sensual thing.
Right? Well, sensual things can happen without consciousness, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But you're still aware of how happy you are.
Hmm. I mean, well, or isn't that his argument about happiness? Is that true happiness is not worrying about whether you're happy or not, whether or not thinking whether you're happy, it just exists.
God damn it, man, that's good stuff. I told him about our podcast. He's going to have to listen to it now. That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah, part of my pleasure of the communing with the Godhead is my pleasure of that communion. Mm. And these people, no, that's not there anymore, man. It has nothing to do with pleasure or ego or your happiness or your relief. None of these things. Boom. You're just there, right?
Exactly.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Damn straight, man.
I feel like you've known that, though. I feel like when I've gone on hikes with you, I feel like that's how you respond when you're... I mean, it comes out of you naturally, I think.
I respond to my happiness. and I don't know. We're going to have to... We should get some comments on this last... on this last couple of minutes, man. We should.
Yeah.
True story.
It would be interesting. It would be interesting to hear different takes on it. I mean, considering we're just in the flow of our own consciousnesses.
Right.
Well, that's the interesting thing about podcasts is you can't pre-plan that. It's, you
know. No, that's... I think you've got... We've got... You got to the real crux of it. So to end this podcast, I have to tell you that in terms of random motion and chaos theory and open-ended stuff,
mm-hmm.
So I took my beautiful babe up, and she doesn't want to ski, so I walked into Scout Mountain after the earliest heavy snowfall in history, or at least the last 40 years I've been here, and the last half hour was 2.5 feet deep, differential snow.
Wow.
It was a struggle, and she was wonderful. We come out, and then we come out, and I knew it. I said, button up, baby. We came out into a 15, 20-mile steady wind. It was freezing, and on top of that, she fell into some snow, and she forgot to put her gloves on, I told her. But anyway, make a long story short, I had, when I filled up, decided, well, I'll just buy a little six-pack since I'm here of really good IPAs.
Yeah.
So when we got back the car, there was a really nice cold IPA for both of us to drink. So I'm driving down the road, and I'm like really starting to warm up. By the time I get to the bottom of East Fork Road and turn on the Mink Creek, and I'm driving down, I'm starting to feel pretty good about everything. And it's late afternoon, and we're driving down, there's a kind of a looping road down past Cherry Springs. So there's these little dips there, so you can't really see. So I, all of a sudden, ahead of me, I see what looks like a bunch of wild turkeys on the road, which of course they're there. But being nearsighted, I have to get a little closer as I'm approaching, and I see that, no, these are not wild turkeys. These are like 9 or 10 little cow dogs running down the road, just scampering side to side, but they're not really orderly. They're chaotic, man. These are like particles that are moving in all directions. And I'm going, what the hell is this? And then I see the big gold conches and the cowboy galloping down the road on asphalt with his lariat. And then I suddenly come down another dip and I see that these 9 dogs are chasing a big black Angus cow. And not only that, they're kind of nipping at it, and the cow is kind of kicking at them. And one of the dogs just decides to jump up and grab hold of the cow's tail. This is all happening in front of me. And I'm thinking, the great lore of Idaho cowboys is it only takes one good cow dog to herd 30 cows.
Yeah.
Here's this dickhead
with 9
harassing one fucking black Angus cow, man. And on top of that, when I get close, he suddenly stops and rises in the stirrup and raises his lariat like he's going to like lasso this just for the camera, man. And then the cow is going off into the creek and the dogs follow. And I drive on and I'm going, the new Idaho cowboy, man. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. But just try to perceive what the hell is going on. It was really lucky I wasn't stoned, man. It would have been too it would have been too much for me.
Yeah.
But that's what's called a random event.
Yeah, that is a...
And you know, my final take on this, Jonah, was who I really felt sorry for was that beautiful horse going, how the fuck did I sign up for this operation?
You know, if we could understand animal consciousnesses, that would be great. Because like horses have to have the most complex of all the animal consciousnesses. Like, yeah, they've got to have like they could have Freudian analysis probably. You know, they've got like anxiety, like, and they get attached to their masters, and it's like, you know. I don't know.
Okay, yeah, they're pack animals. They get attached, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm telling you, man, this horse is going, this is the most fucked up thing I've ever gotten involved with, man.
I mean, and it's funny because I actually know exactly what road you're talking about, and it's pretty, you know, it's pretty steep pitched on both sides.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like one side's the mountains, the other side's going down into the into the creek, and chasing a black Angus cow down
with nine cows. I mean, what I'm saying is that this is an open-ended thing, man. How could that possibly be true? I mean, what the hell was this guy doing?
Yeah.
But yeah, the odds of me coming upon nine cow dogs chasing one black Angus and a noble cowboy voting for Trump with his lariat, you know, I'm thinking, okay, you're going to lasso this cow and this beautiful horse pony is on asphalt and... what's going to happen now?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just couldn't believe it, man.
Yeah.
And
just let the cow go, right? go get it later or something. What, you know, like what's going on? Yeah.
Yeah. Which is the final epilogue for our podcast. What's going on?
I thought it was going to be let the cow go. Which is more like symbolic and that based on analogy, which I've been...
Well, that's a good thing. John Dewey would like that. You go from a basic judgment to effective response, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. That was great, man.